Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome, everybody, and the listeners to another beautiful podcast of the Strong Source Podcast. Today, we have a guest all the way on the other side of the world in New Zealand. So we had to get up extra early for you, Richard. So it has to be a very good podcast this time. So welcome, Richard Allen, president of the Fonterra Global Ingredients Business. I learned that, and everybody in the whole world learned that you divested the consumer business, so even more on ingredients, even more on commodities. So I think you're in the right podcast in this case. So I'm very happy that you're here. Of course, with my dairy background, I know Fonterra really well, and I'm super excited that you're here in the podcast. I look forward to discuss with you everything about the world of commodities and how you ended up in this position and on the other side of the world. So welcome to this podcast again.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
So the first thing we always ask is, tell us a bit about yourself. Tell us a bit about how you ended up into the world of ingredients. I mean, dairy in New Zealand is not that difficult to end up as you're so big in your own country. But in your role in the commodities, yeah, tell us your story a bit.
Yeah, sure thing. So, well, firstly, it's great to be here and feel quite humbled. I've listened to a couple of your previous ones, particularly enjoyed Rob Gosman's one. I thought that was such an interesting podcast, right? So hopefully we can do a little bit of justice tonight. But yeah, Richard Allen, I run Fonterra's global ingredients business. So Fonterra is a large New Zealand dairy cooperative. And yeah, it's been a bit of a long story for me. I was obviously born in New Zealand. I came out of a family that are not dairy farmers, although grandparents were dairy farmers and had an uncle that was a dairy farmer. I actually grew up overseas. So I spent most of my childhood in Southeast Asia and then came back to New Zealand. Didn't really love university, if I'm honest. So I kind of looked how I could get out of there as quickly as possible. And I kind of heard of Fonterra, but I'd probably be the first to admit I certainly wasn't deeply knowledgeable. But their grad program came up, and it was between staying at uni and doing some more study or applying for the grad program, and that looked a lot more enticing. And so I was very lucky to join the Fonterra graduate program in 2008, January 14th, 2008. And yes, spent my career sort of traversing the global value chain from, you know, everything from on through, you know, optimization, the way we run our assets, and then quite a bit of time out in the markets, you know, in China, and then most recently up in Chicago. And yeah, recently moved home. So it wasn't, definitely nothing's been pre-planned. We're coming on 18 years now. And if anyone had said to me, you'll be 18 years in Fonterra, I certainly wouldn't have believed them. But yeah, very privileged to have had the career and the opportunities I've had. It's a wonderful co-op and it's a great industry.
That's amazing. And 18 years, that's a long time. If you look at here in Amsterdam, people shifting after a few years already to something new. There must be something special about either the industry, the dairy industry that drags you back in, or it's the company, or maybe a combo.
You know, New Zealand's largest company. And I think, you know, there's not many places that you can kind of get the experience that you can get and the offshore opportunities. And yeah, just some of the stuff that me and the family have got to experience is pretty special. So yeah. It's a great company.
Could you elaborate a bit on the company? Because indeed, it is New Zealand's biggest company, but it is also the biggest dairy exporter in the world. Can you explain a bit how the company is organized, what it does, how it operates?
Yeah, so I mean, the company was formed in 2001. It was actually the result of many, many, many decades of mergers of smaller dairy cooperatives. So the company in itself, you know, and all of its predecessor companies has been around for over 150 years. We collect right around 80% so of New Zealand's milk, and we're owned by just over 8,000 farming families here in New Zealand. We process that, and about 95% of what we produce, we actually export. So the New Zealand domestic market is relatively small. There's only, you know, just over 5 million people based in New Zealand. So we heavily rely on export markets. And, you know, over the last sort of probably 50 years, a big part of what we've done is gone out there and really pioneered and grown, you know, the markets for dairy right around the world, particularly in those markets where dairy, you know, isn't easy to produce. So a lot of the equatorial sort of the oil countries and all that, it's quite different to, you know, European dairy and US dairy, and that, you know, you have very large, you know, domestic businesses, and sort of the export market is the second thought for us. Very much the export market drives what we do, and it's how our farmers make the majority of their living.
Okay. And then in terms of products, what range of products do you make?
Yeah, so I mean, we do have a consumer business, and you know, we touched on that earlier on. We're actually in the process of divesting our consumer business. Our consumer business operates across our largest businesses are in New Zealand and Australia, and then we have some pretty significant positions across Southeast Asia and South Asia up into China. That is, you know, the typical sort of dairy consumer products. So think sort of cheeses, butters, milks, and milk powders, and you know, some more specialized powders in the aging category and the growing up milk and infant categories. But really, the you know, 80% of our business is our ingredients business, and the ingredients business really does everything it possibly can with milk. So our job is to take fresh milk, which you know is highly perishable, and then turn it into products that are shelf stable and really are functional and can go into you know food and nutrition applications right around the world. So the bulk of what we produce, so about 50% of what we produce, is in the form of whole milk powder. So think raw milk, but in its dried form. And then the remainder of what we produce, the other sort of million odd tons that we produce, we effectively fractionalize the bucket of milk. So we take it apart. So we turn it into its fat components, so butter and anhydrous milk fats. We then turn it into its protein components, so either skim milk or even further into milk protein concentrates or whey and casein. All of those are largely in powder formats. And yeah, I think, you know, we've spent the last sort of 100 years innovating what we do with milk and how we fractionalize it. And you know, when you take milk apart, then it becomes, you know, really functional into lots of different nutrition and food applications right around the world.
I find that very interesting. And it makes me think a little bit about a discussion we had with the Goldman Sachs head of commodities research. And that was the former podcast that we had. And we talked about, you know, we talked about oil. And he didn't use the word fractionating, but oil is also like something that you have so many different products that come out of the barrel. And when you have people in society talking, for example, about climate change, they sometimes say something very easy sounding like just stop oil. Now, obviously, the dairy industry is also exposed to people who talk about climate change. And I saw an ad on Dutch television a couple of times already with Gordon Ramsay, where he's sitting on a cow with a cake in his hand. And the ad says basically, skip the cow. And there is some other product that is apparently replacing dairy. And he says, well, look, we can make this cake without dairy, right? Now, my question is, does the market or do people actually realize how many products are made at the moment from milk? So the idea that you can skip the cow on a scalable basis, that it is, you know, that it's not realistic. Or do you think it is realistic? And is Fonterra also looking at, you know, responding to the notion that the agriculture and maybe especially the dairy industry with all the cows has an impact on climate change?
It's a big question. There's a lot in that one.
there's a lot in it. But
let's unpick it, right? Because I think when you look at dairy, we think a lot about this, right? And if you actually think about dairy, there's a lot of roles it plays, right? One, it will play a functional role in foods. So whether you're adding a fat or a protein, which might be a stabilizer, or a fat which carries a flavor, 100%, you know, there are other options for that, right? But dairy is so much more than just its functional purpose, right? One, you know, in terms of the completeness of the source of nutrition, so the inclusion of, you know, macro and micronutrients, that, you know, essential amino acids, all of those things are very difficult to replicate, right? And there is something about sunshine and rain and that creating milk, you know, that is truly special. The other thing, obviously, with dairy, and I won't comment on Gordon Ramsay, but anyone who's watched him cook, he tends to use a lot of butter, right? Yeah. But butter tastes good, right? And so, you know, at the end of the day, consumers want things that taste good and that are nutritious, right? And you really can't go much further than dairy when you kind of look at those two things coming together. If we think back to the 80s, right, it was butter's dead, margarine's the future and all that. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness that, you know, that we've seen through that, and consumers now very much are back eating butter, and they're eating butter more than they ever have. You know, we're seeing significant growth in butter categories, significant growth in yogurt categories. Fluid milk for the first time, I think, since 2008 in the US is now growing. So 100% there are other things that can do what dairy does. I just don't think there are many that can do it in the way that dairy does in its complete form. And I think there will always be a very strong portion of consumers that see that, that want to eat natural foods and want to eat foods that taste good.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. But it's funny that you said about, Martijn, that you said about products that people don't know about, right? So one of the things that I learned when I was trading dairy is that, you know, everybody knows the butter and, you know, the raw milk and the yogurts and creme fraiche, et cetera, all the basic things that you can do in supermarkets. But there are big pharmaceutical companies that buy dairy to, if you have a little pill,
correct,
that, you know, dairy correct, lactose, for example, holds the pill together. Nobody knows. And probably all these people have, when they have a headache, they take it and they have no clue that they're actually having a bit of dairy in it. So I think there are a lot of, I know that even occasions I use it in glue or things like that for the labels for you know, a bottle of beer. So people have no clue about where it's all being used for, besides, of course, the famous products. And I even didn't know it in the beginning when I was trading. So I think there are a lot of applications on that.
And the other point there is just, you know, like some of the most advanced medical applications require, you know, some of our, you know, our highest functioning dairy proteins and hydrolysates and the like. And these things keep, you know, premature babies all the way through to sort of, you know, palliative care patients alive and make them comfortable and feed them nutrition. Like, I agree. I mean, the use cases for dairy are far and wide. And I don't know, I'm biased, but, you know, I'm really proud of the role that dairy plays in terms of, you know, the global nutrition story.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, still something related to it, which I'd like to understand. So in Holland, there is a crisis, well, there are a couple of crises.
Global
one
crisis
of them is called the nitrogen crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Holland, maybe not many people know, but Holland, after the US, is the biggest agricultural exporter in the world. So we are a tiny country, right? But we export a lot of agricultural products, much more than we consume. So in a sense, it's the same as New Zealand, which is also a small country, but even smaller than Holland in terms of population. So there is a discussion going on, okay, well, why do we have this huge herd of cattle and pigs and poultry and the impact on nitrogen? Now, and why is that an issue? Because of nitrogen close to landscapes, it also prohibits building of houses, which is another crisis. Now, my question is that at all an issue in New Zealand or not at all?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the word sustainability, right? It's a big word, right? It's been an emotive word for some time. Up until probably 2018, 2019, when you talked about sustainability in New Zealand, the only thing the New Zealand public, you know, correlated to sustainability was water quality, right? And so, you know, we have to be honest, right? Dairy has had an impact on the environmental and water quality in New Zealand due to the rapid rate of expansion of it. We realized that, you know, in the mid to late 2000s, before 2010. And so we've been on a big journey over the last sort of 20 odd years to really go, how do we make sure we're dairy farming in a way that isn't sort of detrimental to environmental outcomes? And so, you know, huge amount of things that the New Zealand farmers done, fencing waterway, you know, understanding stocking rates, when you spread effluent, all the things that I know Dutch dairy farmers and US dairy farmers, you know, they're not, nutrient loading has been a topic for a long time for dairy farmers. And I think you can always get better at it, but a huge amount of science that goes into it now, a huge amount of focus and data and technology that goes in and around it. We're very clear now on what we do that impacts it and what are those steps we can do to help mitigate it. And in a lot of areas, you know, how do we actually start shifting towards, you know, a future of nature positivity in terms of the way we farm? And I fundamentally believe that there is a role that, you know, you can have agriculture and biodiversity and regenerative sort of outcomes that are positive to nature.
Yeah, we need to feed the growing world, huh?
Correct.
Yeah.
If you look at your ingredients business, so you now that will be the focus for you and your team, your organization. What will that mean that you have now full focused on? What is the impact for your company on the fact that you said, well, we're going to focus on ingredients? Does that change a lot within the organization if you divest the consumer business?
So our focus is very much B2B now, right? So we have two key B2B channels. One was our ingredients business and the other is our food service business. And so Tehan runs our food service business. You know, we're about a year into the process of divestment of our consumer business. So we announced it right around sort of May last year that we were going to explore divestment. And then, you know, we spent the last year sort of validating that. And now we're very much in a process where we're pursuing sort of a dual track process where we're going to pursue both an IPO and a trade sale at the same time. And we're well into that process. And, you know, we are a highly integrated company, right? So we've spent the last 30, 40, 50 years, you know, building an integrated consumer all the way through to ingredients, all the way through to on-farm business. So to divest a consumer business in a business like ours is a very significant step. You know, you've got to look at everything from your ERP systems to your data to, you know, shared resources, IT infrastructure, all of those types of things. So that's exactly what we're doing right now. What's super interesting for me in this process is when we think about, you know, the allocation of our milk, you know, overnight, you know, we'll go from having, you know, overnight we'll create, you know, one of our largest customers in this new consumer business, right? And so, you know, going through the process now of designing what those contracts look like and how we set that up for success. And, you know, it's a fascinating process, but yeah, it's super complicated because this business has been integrated into the way we do things for so long.
But does that, and also does that mean that you have to restructure the sales of how you do it, how you, you know, you go to the markets and...
Yes and no. I think from our ingredients business, it's always been fairly arm's length with our consumer business. And that's because in some markets, our consumer business competes with, you know, some of our largest ingredients customers, right? So it's always been really important to have clear separation of duties. Where there's a little bit more overlap is between our consumer and food service businesses, where, you know, our consumer business, our largest consumer brand, for instance, is under our anchor brand, and our food service business is under our anchor food professionals business, right? And so understanding, you know, the separation of that, you know, how that works, portion of our markets, there's been some work in that, but largely in our ingredients business, it's status quo, with the exception that we now need to kind of resource up to create, you know, the support services for this new customer mainland once the divestment's complete.
Hey, can you share with us something about how you manage price risk? Because, you know, the dairy market has a perception of being very volatile.
Certainly does. Certainly does. And that's, yeah, like it's pretty crazy, you know, the volatility that we see. And it's not so much even at a total dairy, but then when you go into a specific product level, you know, if you take whole milk powder, let's say longer on average or, like, you know, last 5 year average, 3,500 a ton, you know, we can go plus or minus $1,000 within, you know, 6 to 8 months. And that sort of volatility is pretty significant. We really saw the volatility start to come about, must have been like 2007, 2008. And, you know, to be fair, that volatility, it's taken us probably, well, the best part of, you know, 20 years to figure out how we manage that volatility. And we've been building the capability to manage that volatility. And really, I guess the catalyst for building that capability is probably threefold. One is, you know, our ability to actually manage price risk within our contracts is really critical. You know, we've been a listed entity now for a few years, and we all know that volatility is not great in earnings either way.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the market doesn't like surprises. So we've had to learn to think about and measure volatility and put in place strategies for managing it. But then on the flip side, you know, our customers, you know, procurement hate volatility, right? And for a commodity which is super volatile, that's kind of a dangerous place to be, because if you're super volatile and you're meaning that you're, you know, heavily impacting the COGS of any particular SKU of a customer, you know, they will look to substitute out if they can't manage their margins effectively, right? And so a big part of how we've learned to manage price risk and the tools we've developed in our participation in the markets has been about creating tools to enable our customers to manage dairy price risk better. And you know, we've seen some pretty significant growth in the proportion of our customers that utilize our price risk tools and that are now participating directly in derivative markets and the like. And that's a really good thing. And then the final kind of element is, you know, volatility then also flows through to on-farm. And again, you know, farmers run relatively tight margins and on a relatively high cost base. And we've definitely had, you know, years in my history with Fonterra where, you know, farmers have been waking up and losing money every day for over a year, right? So for us, you know, how do we develop the right tools and services to also offer volatility management, you know, solutions to our farmers? And actually it's been a really symbiotic kind of relationship where by offering price risk to our farmers, we can then back to back that with price risk for our customers. And as a result, through that transaction, we also help ourselves manage price risk as well. And so it's an area that's growing fast. It's an area that we've invested pretty heavily in over the last 20 years. And we see, you know, I see the market continuing to evolve, you know, rather rapidly in terms of the, you know, the derivative markets and the indices and all that support dairy pricing.
Because is that what you see also in the risk management? Is that, for example, what you say about these indices and the volatility that clients don't like at all? In the world of sugar, for example, you see a lot of index link contracts, or you see buying for a year ahead, etc. In dairy, there's always been a part of the industry doing a lot of spot business, etc., where you, of course, you deliver to the world of volatility. Is that a reason? Because I have the feeling that the dairy market buyers are doing more and more kind of index link contracts to manage that risk. And is that then good for Fonterra?
Yes. So 100%, we've seen a fairly small portion of our book, historically would be on long-term contracts or index-based contracts, to now where this is this is usually the standard pricing mechanism in our largest contracts with our largest customers. Is it's usually centered around agreement around an index and then a basis to the index. And that's super important. And the reason that's important is, you can't have long-term partnerships with customers where one side of the party is losing for 12 months, right? It feels great when you're on the upside and it's terrible on the downside. And it's really hard to build long-term, trusted, innovative supplier relation or customer relationships when, you're always talking price or someone's always winning and someone's always losing. So yeah, it's something that we see, it's had significant growth and I see it continuing to grow.
Hey, for the audience, I think it's interesting to explain the mechanics of how that works with an index.
Sure. So effectively, let's say I'm signing a deal for 2 years with a customer, right? One option is we say, you want to buy my whole milk powder? I'll sell your whole milk powder at $3,500 a ton, right? And we all know whole milk powder can go plus or minus 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 across that period. And so maybe half the time they win, half the time we win, or usually in my history, all 24 months I lose, right? And so then you get in trouble and you've got to explain to the big bosses why the contract's out of the money. But effectively, instead of that, what you can do is go, well, why don't we both just say the price will be the price as is on the day? And how do you calculate the price on the day? Well, what you then need to point to is some form of a reputable index that, we both agree, both parties agree, we're happy to accept that what that price is the price at which we'll price this contract. And so for us, we launched GDT back in 2008, which is an online, auction platform, for want of a better term. We've divested part of our ownership in that, and we've really looked to drive GDT as one reputable price index that we use to both price our milk in New Zealand, but also what we form the basis for a lot of our contracts. And then from that, you've seen, the advent of dairy derivatives that then either settle to it or at least it's a great reference point around, whole milk powder, skim milk powder, butter, futures and the like. So it doesn't really matter what you choose. You just got to have confidence on both sides that the thing that you point to in the contract to which you will price the contract, you both have confidence in.
Yeah, so my question was, why is it that liquidity in dairy futures hasn't really taken off? And what is Fonterra doing about it? Because when you have liquid futures markets, and it is an incentive for the physical players to conduct far forward business. So as an industry, at the end of the day, I think a well-functioning futures market really enables the industry to grow. Because when you can mitigate price risk, and when you have this reputable, reliable benchmark for global prices, that attracts people to the industry. So Emma, that's my question to you. So why is it, and what is Fonterra doing about it to really stimulate using the futures markets?
Yeah, and we would agree. And in terms of the exact reason for why, honestly, I'm not sure, other than we know that different commodities have taken different sort of paths on this, right? You've had some that have been, liquid and have liquid and deep financial derivatives for decades. There are others that have come in relatively new in terms of this journey, right? And you think where palm oil's come into and the like. So what we know, though, is if you kind of look at the trajectory and some of the key metrics in terms of, the financial versus physical contracts traded and the like, we are starting to see some good development across dairy markets. If, whole milk powder is now over 1-for-1, I think, in terms of financial to physical. The other markets are getting there, but will take time. And we see this as really critical. And so, as I kind of alluded to earlier, this is something that we've sort of prioritized as a critical enabler for our business. And so since 2008 is when we first created what we called then our commodity risk and trading team under a guy called Bruce Turner, who was out of the electricity sector. And, since then, Bruce and Dave McGowan and the like have built a pretty awesome team in terms of getting out there, firstly understanding the markets, getting brokers into the markets, getting customers involved. And it is just a little bit of a journey, right? And so we're out there every day, you know, taking positions, you know, looking to make markets, you know, looking to offset risk in our book. And we see some pretty exciting, I think, prospects. And what we're hoping is that, you know, to an extent that, you know, you move from a period of somewhat linear growth into more exponential growth as you know, people take notice, you know, the indices become more reliable, the derivatives become more reliable. And then all of a sudden, you know, you start to get outside participants coming in, sort of chasing that vol. So I can't say exactly why. We are actively supporting the growth, and we're super positive on the direction of it's taking. And you know, the more getting involved, the better. And so we spend a lot of time educating customers, a lot of time educating farmers, and then you know, a lot of time with brokers and other participants to get them involved.
I think it's also interesting for attracting talent, because when you think about commodities, you think about eggs, metals, and energy. Mm-hmm. And when you think about eggs, you think about the grains, you think about coffee, cocoa,
sugar,
you name them. And dairy is not so often mentioned. While it is a huge market, it's an exciting market. And I think that a well-functioning futures market will also put that market more on the map.
I agree. We totally agree.
But I think that if I look at the other commodities where you started selling online as well, right? I think that's also something really innovative in the sense that and new, where you see, you know, I don't see that happening in a lot of the other commodities, Martijn. If you look at, you know, the other industries, there's still a lot of bilateral agreements, and of course that will maybe always stay. But I think that you also start to selling online via tools, etc. That mindset of that also helps with risk management, with transparency, with all these kind of things. So I think there you've got a very forward look on that side.
Yeah, and you know, that was some pretty pioneering, you know, efforts from people a long time before me that kind of, you know, took that, because it was pretty scary, right? When we launched Global Dairy Trade, which is our online platform, our luck was we launched it in 2008, right? And we all know what happened in 2008 in terms of the GFC. And so I was only probably 6 months into the cooperative. And I think for the first, I don't know, at least six months of events, we just saw the price go down, down, down. And to actually kind of hold the nerve and kind of see that long-term picture around actually price transparency in the long term being the best thing for the industry, it took a lot of, you know, foresight and a lot of confidence and a lot of bravery, if I'm honest, to keep with it and to have the development of the Global Dairy Trade Auction. And now what's also great to see is we're seeing a lot of other platforms pop up and doing similar things. You know, there's what you guys are doing with Vespa, but then, you know, there's Nui, there's a numerous other EEX, you know, popping up. And I think that's a really good thing for dairy, that, you know, there is more transparency and there are more indices popping up that allow us to go out there and work with customers to manage risk.
Yeah, so I agree. You know, we at Vespa, of course, we launched the marketplace for dairy because I truly believe that a part of the business will done online and for especially standardized products, and it creates transparency. And when we did the interviews before we invest in it, everybody said buyers and sellers didn't mind the size. They said we want more transparency. We want to buy online, sell online, part of our business. And I truly believe that that's where commodities are going towards, and not just dairy. I think it's for other ones as well. I mean, if you look at sugar, for example, why sugar in Europe, the sugar is the sugar, right? So if you sell 10 containers, why should that be then? Why cannot it not go on an online platform, just as an idea? So however, I wanted to also touch upon, you know, the role that you have and in this, volatile environment, black swan events, tariffs, everything that's going on. You're in this role. You just moved to New Zealand, so there will be a lot of traveling for you, I guess, from there onwards. How do you deal in your position with all of this that's going on? I mean, you just moved into back home, New Zealand, divesting business, running your current business, volatility, everything has to go on. People need your attention. Then you got all the black swan events. I mean, you must be having long days.
Yeah, look, I mean, I can't remember any easy days since COVID, if I'm honest. Like, COVID really was the kickoff of so much volatility that we see now, right? And, you know, whether it was the ship getting stuck in the canal, in the Suez Canal, then it was, Panama Canal ran out of water, and then we had a war, and then we had port strikes, and it's like, you name it, we've kind of faced it from a supply chain perspective. I think one of the things that we've focused a lot on is, you know, we do scenario planning, but it's very rare that any scenario you plan for actually plays out the way in which it does. Where we've really focused on our sort of organizational capability is in the robustness of our processes and the ability to respond. And so that agility and the ability to kind of take new information and then calmly process it and then come out and go, well, hey, this isn't perfect, but it is what it is. And you've got to deal with what's in front of you and then trust your processes to then kind of create an answer or a playbook or a set of tactics that then allow you to make the best, right? You can't always make money and you can't always maximize value, but what you can do is in some of these situations, minimize loss. And so one of the things I think that, you know, we certainly have a lot of areas we need to get better in, but one of the areas I think we do, you know, pretty well as a cooperative is that ability to manage, you know, supply chain disruption or any form of disruption via kind of robust processes. And so, you know, right now, for instance, with, you know, all that's going on in terms of the tariffs, our ability to kind of almost daily sort of take in the new information and then, you know, as and when needed, sort of update the supply plan, update the demand plan, and then spit out kind of, well, what is the set of tactics that we're going to go after? That's pretty good. And we actually learned that through COVID, right? That was the craziest I can remember in terms of trying to run a business, but then you're trying to run it remotely. And then a country shuts down and then a channel shuts down and then there's no airplanes and then chips don't turn up to the bottom of the world. Like that really did build a good amount of muscle, particularly in our organization, because we are so far from everywhere in terms of that ability to just sort of roll with crisis and then create a plan that makes the best of it.
Yeah. Now, I was also thinking about that question that Alex raised. And in the pre-call, you and I, we had a quick chat about, you know, how I dealt with it, setting up a remote trading desk. But I think what Alex is also referring to and what our audience is really interested in is personal stories, meaning the scenario planning that you say in the process, that is critical. But what the audience also wants to understand, how do you deal with these things personally as a human, right? Because at the end of the day, what makes the podcast interesting, I think, is that people see who are the movers and shakers of this industry, that they're not perfect, that they have doubts, yeah, and that they are usually very strong team builders. So my question to you is, as a person, think about that COVID period that we talked to, or the Ukraine invasion, these type of things, and now the turbulence with regards to terrorists. How do you deal with that as a person? How do you make sure that you remain calm? And that, for example, when you come home, then you are a nice spouse and nice for your kids, right? I wasn't always nice to my kids, I realized in hindsight, because, you know, I had to deal with all this intensity and I was thinking about, you know, the P&L swings. And to be able to be successful in this business with so much intensity and volatility, you need to have not so much a strong ego, but a strong consciousness to be calm and stable and kind and deal with all those things. And also being a good example for the people that you lead. Because if you panic, they think, hey, the situation is not under control. So maybe internally you're panicking, but you shouldn't show it to that extent. But then again, showing vulnerability and also showing that you as a leader do not have all the answers and come with questions to your team is also good, right? So how do you deal with these things personally?
It's a great question, right? And it's, you know, it's something that I've had to work on a lot, if I'm honest, over the years. And there's been periods where I've got it horribly wrong, if I'm totally honest. And usually when you get it wrong, it's actually not work that suffers. It's usually the personal life that suffers in terms of, you know, you focus too much, you work too long hours, and then, you know, it's the home life that usually gets the remainder of the fraction, right? And so I think one of the things that I work on constantly, and it's something, you know, when I'm talking to, you know, some of our younger people coming through, and you know, I've spent a lot of time in my career on my personal brand. So what are those things that are really, really critical to me that I want to be known for, right? And it's something that's very personal and it's different to everybody. And I spend probably every quarter, every year, you know, something like that, just periodically I sit down and actually I've got a piece of paper where I document what I want to be known for and what I want that personal brand to be. And the reason that's really important is that when you get into these tough situations, or you get into tough meetings or that, once you've written it down, it kind of sits at the back of your head, right? And what it allows you to do is just constantly calibrate. And so there'll be meetings that I'll come out of and I'll go, man, being a dick, like totally not how I wanted to show up. And I don't know about Vespa, but the good part about Fonterra is there's always another meeting, usually in 5 minutes. So, you know, you can kind of, you know, run to the next meeting room and reset and recalibrate, right? And I think it's that once you define what is that North Star or what is it that you're trying to, why are you here? You know, what are you trying to achieve? Then it allows you to calibrate because, you know, you're not going to get it right all the time and no one does. And anyone who does probably isn't pushing hard enough in my view. But having that sort of center and knowing what that center is, you can always course correct, right? You have a bad meeting, you can always apologize. You can always sort of be vulnerable and say, hey, geez, I was off the mark there, or, you know, hey, I've thought about it and, you know, I want to change the decision. But if you don't know what that center is and you don't know what that North Star is, then I think you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. And that's when ego creeps in and all sorts of things creep in. So I don't have a perfect recipe. I've got an amazing team. I spend a lot of time. I often find when things get, you know, tough or the stakes get higher or crisis sets in, you know, the ability to come together in the team. And you can't do that if you haven't invested in the team beforehand. But you really, you know the strength of a team, not when things are going well, but when things start to get a bit tough, right? And so, yeah, I mean, it would be those two things. I don't know if that's a useful answer, but the only way I've developed that is through some pretty deep self-reflection on when I haven't been happy with how I've been or how I've showed up or what I've been like at home, and then kind of resetting and kind of forgiving yourself a little bit, and then kind of, you know, trying to make amends and whatever is that next step you take.
I think it's a really cool, honest answer.
Yeah, it's very well articulated, and I recognize it 100%. Yeah. Thank you. No, it's very, very helpful for the audience.
This is also what people will follow in a leader, right? So in your role, you know, you have so many people in Fonterra looking at you like, I want to have that role. I want to be like him, or I have that view that how did he get there? And these are the things that these ambitious people will love to hear, you know, how do they do it? Because they don't have the time always to spend with you, of course. How about if you look at, you know, the journey that you've made, how important were they? You've been abroad, you've been raised abroad, you've been in Asia, you lived in the US. How important were the, because that a lot of the young people say, you know, with commodities, when I talk to them, is that, oh, so I can travel, I can go abroad, I can maybe live somewhere else. How important were for you these moments of being abroad, living somewhere else, yeah, to do the job that you do now?
Honestly, for me, and this is a personal opinion, and everyone's different, but for me, they've been fundamental. Like, you cannot talk about a market, and you cannot understand a market unless you've lived and breathed a market. You cannot kind of, you know, when I was running the China food service business, right, and I was living up in Shanghai, and, you know, the number one question, you'd be out in regional China, and you'd be sitting down with these meetings, and, you know, my pigeon Mandarin, but the first question I'd always ask you is, oh, where do you live? And the minute I sort of said, oh, I live in Shanghai, that, oh, okay, so you're not just flying in to try and raise the price or extract money from me or whatever that is, that you actually live and breathe and you've taken the time to learn the language and all that sort of stuff. Like, there is just something about that and kind of experiencing the culture, and exactly the same in the US, right? Because, you know, the thing about being, I guess, a white New Zealander is that you think, oh, but I moved to the US and I'll know what the culture is. It's totally different. It'd be exactly the same as if I moved to the, you know, to Amsterdam or the Netherlands. It's a totally different culture. And so for us, the US is a super exciting market. It's a rapidly growing market. And, you know, for me to deeply understand, you know, our two most important markets, having not lived there, I think is a miss, right? And so I think it's critical. I think, you know, being out in a market, putting yourself in an uncomfortable situation, moving a family abroad, like all of those things, you know, they build resilience. They force you to kind of get out of your comfort zone. And in my opinion, I honestly think I'd be a quarter of the leader, or, you know, and that's still not much, you know, but I would be nowhere near where I am today without having kind of done that offshore experienced different cultures, because business is different everywhere you go in the world, and it's hard everywhere you go. Like, there's not an easy business environment.
And in terms of commodities, because that's also a question that we often get, either in the podcast or I get a lot of those questions, switching from one commodity to the other. And people ask me, is that a wise thing to do, and which one they should start? And I have done vegetable oils and cocoa. A network is becoming important at some stage. So being in a commodity for a long time and having that network and knowing everyone is valuable. But switching from one commodity is also extremely valuable. Like you said, you learn from different geographies and different cultures. You also certainly learn a lot from trading different commodities. You have been your career in dairy now, and dairy has different commodities of different, and you have the derivatives of raw milk, of course, but it's, you haven't traded wheat or cocoa or coffee. Have you thought about trading other commodities as well or not?
Oh, look, I'm just a sales guy, right? So I've never thought about trading full stop, but absolutely. You know, there have been points in the career where you go, well, you know, is it time to, not just even commodities, industries, right? You know, you learn a lot from different industries, different business models and all that. And I've definitely thought about that. I think the way in which I think about that now is that, you know, when I look across a good leadership team, and if I, you know, I look across, you know, my lead team at the minute, it's a mixture of people with deep dairy experience, you know, and then there's people that are relatively new to the industry, which come from other industries, which have, you know, are further ahead in certain aspects and, you know, bring new insights and new networks and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, if you can get cross-industry, cross-commodity experience, 100%, super valuable, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also value in, you know, the deepness, you know, people, you know, and deepness in a single industry. And I don't think it's either or. I think both are super valuable. And then it's about the team you put around it, right? So if you have a team full of deep only dairy experts, that's not going to be as strong as a team full of, you know, people from lots of different experiences or industries. So I honestly think, you know, I'm just one of a team, and, you know, my role is pretty clear in terms of what I bring, but there are many around me that bring those other sort of really important facets. You know, like other industry, other commodity experience.
Now, what our audience, and there's a lot of young people in our audience, huh? What they always want to know, what are you looking for in candidates for? And let me then focus a bit more on commercial roles. What are the things when you receive a resume or cover letter, when you have an interview, what are you looking for?
It differs, right? It differs on the agent stage. But if we focus maybe at the younger end to begin with, and then I can talk about more senior roles. But at the younger end, honestly, degrees and grades, interesting. But for me, it's an attitude and it's a work ethic and it's a humility thing. I think the most successful grads and sort of earlier career individuals that I've seen come through the business have been those that are, you know, have a strong work ethic, you know, willing to put the hand up for anything. You know, want to learn, want to make mistakes, want to take risk, all of those types of things, right? Because, you know, if you come in thinking you know everything, you're not going to learn anything, right? And so that attitude piece for me in younger careers is the most important, right? And that flexibility and the sort of agility to go, I'm open to doing anything, right? If you come in an early career and say, this is my next role and this is the role after and I'm only doing that, you're going to have a hard time, right? Versus those that come in and go, hey, I trust the co-op or I trust the organization to know what's good for me, and I'll invest in the company and the company will invest in me, right? So that flexibility, that work ethic and just getting stuff done and getting stuff done for people, nothing substitutes that in my opinion. I think then as you move kind of into more senior roles, delivery of results is really critical. But delivery of results, you know, there's a few things that can go into that. But really, I like to get an understanding that people understand why the results have been delivered. Like what are the fundamental sort of business drivers or actions that have been taken that have delivered those results, right? And that usually comes from a deep understanding of, you know, in the business you were in, how did it make money? And it sounds like a really simple question, but the majority of businesses don't earn money from the contracts they sign. They earn money from the way in which they operate and the channels in which they operate and the ways they go to market and the ways they're structured and those types of things. And so for me, that kind of deep business, it's sort of like being inquisitive around how the business works and how business works is really important.
I think that's a fantastic answer. I recognize it so much. You know, I've asked so many times to people who came with an idea, which sounded interesting holistically, and they liked to use that term holistic. And then I asked, can you please tell me how are we going to make more money with this, or money in the first place? Can you show me the numbers? And that is quite difficult for a lot of people, right? And, you know, understanding also the P&L of commodities business is not so easy, huh? Mm-hmm. Especially when you have the physical sides, when you have the future sides, when you have far forward business, mark to marking, when you have a margin curve which is as volatile as the underlying commodity itself, you can pump up a P&L, a basis mark-to-marking, a position which is illiquid, and maybe needs to be cashed in 6 months' time, and then you cannot, right? I mean, there's, yeah.
But I think, Martijn, is that also that the roles that you, if you look at the actual trader, right, the guy that is at the, you know, Gunvor or the likes of the Forteras and doing the commodities there, and the commercial guys that are actually selling commodities to end customers like whatever, and selling commodities to Nestle or whatever. It's also a different kind of role, different kind of actually person, I think, that you're looking for and that has different kind of competences. So if I look at that commercial, what I think, Richard, what you are, and I think I relate a lot to that, is that you, if I look at the commercial guys that are doing commodities, I never look at the actual, you know, that they what they studied or whatever. I look at that person because I think you're commercial. If you're commercial, it's already in you. It's already that you, the person that you are. You like to, you get energy. You're an extrovert most of the times. You want to be outside. You want to, you know, challenge customers. You are a bit maybe aggressive, a bit more. You want to get things done. You want to have somebody that rolls up the sleeves. It's a different kind of. And that's, you cannot study for that. And it's good that people study, and I would not discourage that or anything. But I think if you look at commercial roles, I always look at that, you know, I thought what you said, Richard, I look at that as well. And if I look at that, you know, that trader, et cetera, and you see that traders become more and more analytical people also with Python skills and these kind of things, right? So I think that also has a different kind of qualifications.
Yeah, I mean, that podcast you did with Rob, you know, the way he described traders, I was like furiously taking notes, right? In terms of that kind of risk, they either have it or they don't. And it's hard to put into words, but, you know, I can think of that there is just an archetype there that, you know, they need that little bit of, I think he called it a little bit of mongrel in them, or that little bit of like edge to them, that ability to take a risk, that sort of nose for money. Like that is critically important, right? And I think that's really important in sales as well, is that do people know how to close a deal? Do they know how to firstly construct a deal and then close it? There's something in that.
Yeah.
Now that is certainly a quality, but I've also experienced situations where a commercial person came to me to the desk and was very excited about a certain business because they did a certain volume, or they did a certain volume times price. So they did a US dollar exposure sale. And then I asked, okay, but why is this a good price? Or what margin is it? Are we going to make money with this? And then it was silent, right? So you need to understand where, coming back to you, Richard, you need to understand where the profitability is. You need to understand after such a deal, what is the exposure? How are we going to manage that? And that's a bit the difference between sales and trading and merchandising. Yeah. No, I know. And also, I think that in terms of the higher echelons, you want to be able to see what the chessboard of the industry, what it looks like, because the industry constantly evolves. And also nowadays with technology or external factors, like we discussed before, you need to constantly look ahead and be able to anticipate how your competitors are moving and how your customers are moving, the regulatory framework, all those things. And you know, those are the people that are going to be successful in the higher echelons.
The only other bit I'd add to that is you've got to be quite brave to be focused. And to actually set a strategy and back it and execute it and not go, oh, if I do five other things, then maybe that'll sort of hedge my bets. And actually, you know, that ability to be focused and brave and back yourself, back your analytics, back your team, and then keep the team on that track. You know, that's something that I think, you know, if you look at patterns of success, usually the one of the number one factors there is the ability to focus on something and do it well.
But how do you do that with the sales guys? Because the sales guys, you have, you know, you are Coop that is based in so many regions, right, around the world. So they come out and they say, but I can now do this amazing sales. I think it's fantastic. I should do it. And they're all fighting for that same splash of milk, right? So how do you deal with that? Because I can imagine they're like, yeah, but, you know, maybe they get bonuses. Maybe they want to keep their client happy. They want to do, you know, they move product. And then, you know, somebody in New Zealand says, well, the valorization of the milk is going to be this. And you're like, oh, crap. there you go. How do you deal with that and the happiness of all the salespeople?
look, I'll definitely say work in progress there, Alex. But now there's two things there. One is getting super clear on what is value, right? What are we actually going for here, right? And making sure everyone is fully aligned on what is your definition of value. The second thing is then you need to spend a lot of time deeply thinking about metrics and KPIs, right? And you know, there's an element of KPIs which at their surface level makes sense, but you know, as you say, you've got a team full of salespeople out there. They will find a way around those KPIs pretty quickly, right? They'll gamify them. They'll gamify them pretty quickly. But
being good salespeople, by the way.
Yeah, correct. When you have a clear, you spend the time to understand your markets and understand the business and understand where you make money. And then you have a very clear plan, which is focused. And each of your regions or each of your customers or each of your salespeople have a clear role as to, well, we're going after this picture here, right? But each of you have a role in delivering on that. And you spend the time to really set those accountabilities and set those roles. And then you run the business that way. And you don't, you know, you resist the temptation of shining new market or shining new product or shining new, you actually back your strategy. And you use analytics to actually ensure that you're working on a basis of facts and not hearsay. Look, I mean, this is a constant work on, right? Like, all of us get distracted and unfocused. And well, what about if we did this? And what about if we did that? But what I find with sales teams is if you're very, very clear on what it is you're going after and you can all unify around a deliverable or a value and a goal and a plan, you know, people want to be on a winning team, right? And then it's about producing results. And then if you can demonstrate through metrics and, you know, progress that actually results are coming out of the bottom of the equation, usually you can build pretty strong momentum in not too long a time. But you got to stay on it, right? And you got to keep measuring. Are we on course? Do we need to change course? But do it in a way which is, you know, strategic and methodical, as opposed to, well, let's try something different today. And that's always the temptation. It's one of my worst habits, is kind of, wow, we could do that, or what about this idea?
All the amazing opportunities.
Correct. It's that, you know, that's the fun part of business, but not where you usually make money. You make money through kind of rinsing and repeating a successful sales model that produces cash.
Yeah. Yeah. But of course, also then you still have that, you know, that 2-3 months transport that you have in, you may have an opportunity, but then it takes time to get it even towards the regions because you're coming from all the way in New Zealand, right? Mm-hmm. So the planning, I can imagine, logistics is for you guys also a key element in driving these commodities around the world, right?
Yeah. So supply chain for us is a, it has to be one of our core competencies, right? Because we are so far away. But the customer doesn't care that you're, 5,000 kilometers away. All the customer cares is that they get the right product at the right time and that it works for them and the products that they're making, right? And so, you know, that's not ever an excuse for us. We can never say, oh, it's not our fault. We're, you know, bottom of the world. We have to make sure that we build and develop a robust supply chain so that our customer experience is never the afterthought. And that's been challenging in the last few years, right? And it still is a daily challenge, you know, even getting containers to come down to the bottom of the world sometimes is difficult, but it's not an excuse. We just got to get better and we've got to find sort of innovative ways around that, right? And there are lots of ways we can do that, right? And there are ways we've sort of developed that through in-market warehousing and you know, more sort of transparent relationships with suppliers where we can do our best to overcome that. But it's a constant work on.
Because then the risk, you have the, you know, you have the markets, you have the opportunities, you have the splash milk that needs to be valorized, you got your logistics. And then I thought about, you know, you have 90% of your product is going all around the world. That means that you also have a big exposure on currencies, right? On because you get your money in from all kind of different regions. How do you, is that also within your role? Is that also within your, is it your problem basically?
No. I can assure you when it's not going the right way, it's my problem. But no, we have a pretty sophisticated central treasury function, which, you know, we the vast majority of what we sell in our ingredients business is in US dollars. But, you know, the US dollar to NZ dollar is still a big exposure for us to manage. But we've had a very sort of, you know, mature and, you know, really well-governed with good risk parameters in terms of the way that we manage FX risk internally. Because, that you know, it can have a material impact on our farmers in terms of, you know, movements in the USD. It doesn't take a lot of movement to have a pretty big impact on the price we pay milk for our farmers. So, yeah, we've got a pretty awesome team that do that for us.
We are at the end of our podcast. You can go to bed, I think, Richard. So I really, really enjoyed this podcast, Richard. I think it was amazing to have this view from you with all the elements that come to it. And I also really liked your honest answers on what it does with you, the empathy that you showed in this episode on commodities and the traveling around the world. I think it's something that is for, you know, people that want to start in commodities. I think it's a big benefit. I think it's an amazing element of this industry. Thank you very much for staying awake for us, telling your story. And good luck with all the challenges that will be ahead for you and your team. And we'll see each other soon.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for the time. We'll talk to you guys then.
Yeah, I also really liked it because we learned a lot about dairy, Fonterra, and also about you. And that is the perfect combination. So thanks a lot for that.
I appreciate it. Great to see you guys. Talk soon.